Side 2 of tape 383, it's April 6, 1979, Nave Russell in Carmel, California. There was an ugly incident in San Francisco last Saturday night at a lesbian bar of some gentlemen, about 20 of them, plainclothesmen. Maybe there were fewer, but I think there were up to 20 plainclothesmen were at a party. A man was getting married the next day, and it was a bachelor party, and the men were drunk. They hired an electric car, similar to the cable cars in San Francisco, I understand, motorized car, and they were on a spree in town, and they all got together and decided, let's get the dykes. So they went down to the part of town where there's a lesbian bar, and they were very obnoxious, and they were drunk, and they were celebrating, as I say, the fact that this gentleman was going to get married the next day. So they decided to break the place up, and the women didn't want them, and they were abusive and drunk, and one of them grabbed a woman by the neck and had her on the floor, and they were beating her up, and they called the police, and the police came, and the group of people were plainclothes. They were officers of the police department, but it was their night off, and they were celebrating this marriage the next day. And they didn't have on their uniforms, and the woman asked for the driver's license of one of the men when they wanted to come in, or some identification, because they were so obnoxious, and she didn't want to give it back, and it identified him as being on the police force, I believe. Well, some men were arrested, and there was a lot of talk on the talk shows in San Francisco, but the San Francisco Chronicle yesterday had an article that the wedding that was to take place the next day was Patty Hearst's wedding, and that the gentleman involved, the groom-to-be, was Bernard Shaw, the soon-to-be husband of Patty Hearst, and that his buddies on the police force were the ones that were in the brawl, beating up the women, going after the dykes and lesbians. Patty left one environment, was kidnapped, and taken for a year and a half, and then when she was in jail and out appealing her case, her bodyguard was this policeman who has total control over her now. She's in a prison. It's a terrible situation. She had a military wedding at a Navy base. She's married to a member of the police department. You can see the dangerous, violent mentality the man has, beating up women. There's an article saying, a follow-up in the paper this morning, or just mentioning that the bachelor party was for Bernard Shaw, but that he wasn't in the crowd. But the earlier reports had intimated that the bachelor party for the fellow officer, that he was there. So now we have to wait to see if he, in fact, was part of that brawl, because it's been very silent in San Francisco. But I think it's a pretty sick situation, and this is the kind of environment. The buddies that she's going to be with are the kind that, like the Klan, can go in and just beat up on women who are minding their own business in a place and feel that they have the authority to abuse people physically and get away with it because they're members of the police department. It's just like Nazi Germany, where the police have the authority to go in and mess up people. If you saw the movie Cabaret or other movies of the Nazi period, and they leave because the police are the Nazis and the Nazis are the police, and so that Patty's husband, Bernard Shaw, keeps this kind of company, and they think they have that kind of authority. So heaven help Patty Hearst, I think it's pretty bad. One woman who takes these tapes asked me, what kind of psychic power do you use to keep optimistic when everybody else is low and blue and calm and they're ready to die or upset about the news? She wrote, what psychic powers do you use to keep happy or whole, or what do you do? I can't explain what I do for my kicks, at least not on the tapes, but I do get satisfaction in seeing the counter forces taking over. And I'm going to talk to you for a few minutes about some good news about bad news, And this comes from the New York Post, Friday, March 16th, 1979. And this has to do about the Howard Hughes burglary, the break-in. Many of you people haven't followed the Howard Hughes case like I have through the years, and I consider myself pretty much an expert on the Howard Hughes case. And one of the big mysteries, one of the counterforces that's been building up, like that bubble that wasn't expected in Harrisburg, was the burglary of the Romaine offices in Los Angeles. The Howard Hughes empire was burglarized several years ago, and it had to be an inside job because they have the tightest security imaginable in that office. And goodness knows what could be taken out of that office, because there were correspondence and documents. I even have some that were in the hotel in Mexico at the time that that body was turned in 1976, were procured by Johnny Meyer, the former aide of Howard Hughes. And they talked about giving Richard Nixon $1 million down at Key Biscayne, which would have to be for covering up the murder of Robert Kennedy, because that's how Richard Nixon became president, and also giving Lyndon Johnson $1 million, which had directly to do with the murder of John Kennedy, and keeping silent on that because the assassination teams were headed by Robert Mayhew, employed by Howard Hughes, and the CIA used the Hughes as a cover. Now, what came out of the burglaries at the time was the little teensy-eensy tip of that famous iceberg. My goodness, there's so many little tips coming out now that we may even get a view of the iceberg someday. But it was the story of the Glomar Explorer and how the CIA had used the Hughes organization to retrieve a sunken Russian submarine, and then that went into the investigation of the Howard Hughes connections to the Glomar. Now, all of us sharing these tapes are reasonable people, and we know that the fact that you burglarize an office and take out the story that the Hughes organization built a submarine for the United States isn't that scandalous, really. They built satellite planes. The Lockheed built the U-2. They make spy planes and all kinds of spy equipment for the intelligence community. So that's not really so scandalous, and we're not even really sure about the Russian story anyway, because they retrieved the bodies and then they threw them over the side anyway again, after saying a prayer in Russian, which doesn't make much sense either. But now there's two books coming out about the burglary at the Romaine Street. And this is the kind of thing which is important and which makes me have confidence that there are moles in this system. That's where I get my information from. I just assimilate it and correlate it. But there's a book coming out now called Citizen Hughes, In His Own Words, How Howard Hughes Tried to Buy America. It's Holt Reinhardt. It's coming out in the fall. The author is Michael Drosnin. Now, the New York Post said Drosnin refuses to comment on the reports that he obtained secret papers from the world's most secretive man. He only said, "I have virtually everything that Hughes himself ever wrote, plus a whole lot more." But he has a book coming out on the burglary, and this is the important thing about that book. There's thousands of secret documents and private papers that were stolen in 1974, just at the height and heat of Watergate, just at the time the Watergate story could link to the John Kennedy assassination, that I had made those connections, just at the time Richard Nixon was going out of office and the people succeeding him were part of the cover-up, Gerry Ford from the Warren Commission. At this time in 1974, those offices were removed of papers. And the details of this book that is coming out, How Howard Hughes Tried to Buy America, goes into the financial dealings from the CIA to Richard Nixon, to the Kennedys, to Lyndon Johnson, and it reports to have a lot of important information that should be very beneficial to studying our whole era. The Howard Hughes name is deleted from the biography, the index of almost every single book on espionage and intelligence, and you have to ask yourself why, because like General Reinhard Galen, and I think he's the most important man next to James Jesus Angleton, you have Howard Hughes, and that name has been deleted because that is one of the umbrellas for the Nazification of America. There is no and was no physical Hughes, really important after 1946, and certainly never after 57, never seen again. And we'll go into that when we talk about who and how and why this country is the way it is. And the important thing is that the Howard Hughes organization if I could say one group represented the Nazification of America, it would be under the guise of the Howard Hughes Organization. Many of you read in the paper last week under the Freedom of Information Act that was declassified that in order to handle the campus riots in the 60s, they were using word for word the speeches of Adolf Hitler. Well, G. Gordon Liddy was down in the archives, National Archives, watching Gestapo pictures. He worked for the Howard Hughes Organization. G. Gordon Liddy did. He was with Robert Mardian and E. Howard Hunt. That gang were over at Mullen Associates, which was an office for the Howard Hughes Organization. Now, this burglary was done as an inside job. And as I say, there are two books coming out on the Howard Hughes burglary. One, Hughes, How He Tried to Buy America. I'm sorry, that word is in the past tense. How They Bought America. And then another book by Jim Steele and Donald Bartlett from the Philadelphia Inquirer. They have a book called Empire. Norton is publishing it. It'll come out next month. This refers to a chapter on the burglary, the same burglary, called the Hughes Gate, the Watergate of the Hughes Empire. And they don't answer the question of who masterminded the plot or what was stolen or the options. But they go into CIA contracts and a little bit about the Glomar, but other documents that were stolen from that office, according to the New York Post, and I know this is true, include transactions with Nixon, with LBJ, with Hubert Humphrey, and the Kennedys on how one man tried to buy the government. Now, this is very important because the past tense is used twice to describe the book. But Howard Hughes was in a plane crash that was near fatal in 1946. The plane crash was just two blocks from my parents' home. I might have mentioned that on other tapes, just two blocks from our home. And directly across the street where some of their cohorts were Bugsy Siegel was murdered on Linden. The crash for Howard Hughes testing a plane in 1946. And he almost died. And he had Dr. Vern Mason save his life. And from that time on, because of broken ribs and extensive complications, Mason was in charge of Howard, and it was at that time with pain and so forth that they began the medications. Later, in 1957, they declared Howard mentally incompetent, and Vern Mason went on to head the Hughes Medical Institute in Miami, and Hughes was never seen again. Now, the years that we're talking about, the years that these books are describing, that involve Richard Nixon and LBJ, or the Kennedys, or Hubert Humphrey, are after the time in 1957 when Hughes was never seen again. And according to the documents, he was doped out of his head for 20 years, if you would believe he existed, the full length up to 76, and I believe it was till 71. He was filled with needles, drugs, incoherent, and so forth, and people were writing and using his name, because even at the time of the Clifford Irving book, the best experts of the world from McGraw-Hill and Life magazine and Osborne and company and so forth said, yes, those are Howard Hughes' handwritings, those are his letters, his memos, and later they turned out to be a fraud. So the same person could be writing the memos through the years if they couldn't tell the difference in 1971, 72, they could have been writing them since. For a long, long time. But the years that they're talking about where he tried to buy the government, and this is important, I don't want to go too fast, and we'll do more, of course, when the books come out. He wasn't even existing. This man lived in a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, was provided with drugs by Jack Agar of the Beverly Hills Police Department and Bobby Hall and a gang around him. He was in that bungalow from 1957 to 1966, where he was taken to a Boston hospital and never seen publicly. A doctor came up from Hughes Medical Institute in Miami. The director of that great institution was the doorman originally, and then again he was taken on a train to Las Vegas and exited there in the hands of Intertel police force in 1970, Thanksgiving night, and he was not seen anywhere in Las Vegas. So all the manipulations and all the papers and documents that are coming out from the Romaine burglary were the works of people using the Howard Hughes name. Oh, I promised you last week that I would get back to Jonestown and do some more on Michael Prokes, and important information on Jonestown, but I thought I would just take a break this week and do an update on some of these matters because they are important, and I want to clear them out with you and not hold on to the information. I did an article for Penn Jones Continuing Inquiry called The Missing Link 2 months ago about John Paisley, missing John Paisley, and the connections to Yuri Nosenko, the KGB defector, Marianne Paisley of the CIA, John and Catherine Hart of the CIA, and Bernard Fensterwald, the attorney representing Marianne Paisley. In response to that article, Victor Marchetti, who wrote the book The Cult of Intelligence, answered with a letter which was printed in the next issue of Penn Jones newspaper, and of course he accused me of errors in the article and didn't address himself to the important questions. And I responded with another letter to Penn, and I brought up the question in the letter of how can you trust CIA people who write books such as Victor Marchetti and even John Marks, who was the co-author of The Cult of Intelligence, that CIA agents are writing books, ex-CIA agents still belong to the CIA, they're trained to lie under oath. And I brought out in this last issue that Penn will hopefully print in the next continuing inquiry, that if you look in the index of The Cult of Intelligence by Victor Marchetti, who claimed he had left the CIA, he leaves out two names, and one is General Reinhard Gehlen, chief of Hitler's Eastern Intelligence, and the other was James Jesus Angleton. And I made the point that if you don't write about James Jesus Angleton and Reinhard Gehlen, it's identical to not learning the alphabet of the English language. In the intelligence alphabet of the CIA, A, Allen Dulles, B, Angleton, or B, Gehlen, and C, Angleton, counterintelligence. And a man who writes a whole book explains the American people about the CIA and leaves out the name Gehlen and James Jesus Angleton, and also Howard Hughes, is not telling us the whole story. Also, Marchetti claims that the Gehlen operation was literally a nest of communist spies, that Richard Helms didn't trust Gehlen and didn't even see him when he had a farewell tour in his retirement. I understand, and according to the books on Gehlen, that up till 1971 he received $200 million from the CIA. And with inflation and with the Gehlen agents still being paid, and it's 8 years later, I would say it's gone into 8 or 10 or 20 times the $200 million up to 1971. And I don't think that's all for communists. And I asked him, Mr. Victor Marchetti, to please address himself to one specific point I made in the continuing inquiry, and that was this. When the Warren Commission was writing their report in 1964, they were approached by the CIA through Isaac Don Levine to bring the daughters of Alexander Zeiger from the Minsk radio factory back to Argentina where they were born. And I want Victor Marchetti to answer in the continuing inquiry a letter, why would the CIA be concerned with helping the man who ran the radio factory where Lee Harvey Oswald worked in the Soviet Union, and the family that introduced Marina to Lee? Why, while the Warren Report is being written, would they want to bring that family back to Argentina? And I think that would be a good starting point for Victor Marchetti to explain how his logic and his facts operate in this case. And if he continues to correspond on this matter, you will see loud and clear that people that proclaim to be ex-CIA people are still very much acting for the CIA. Now, an update on that book, Alternative 3, that I talked about on several tapes 2 weeks ago and the week before that. There was a conference the University of California gave in Monterey, my hometown, next to Carmel, last weekend, on space. It was a conference on the greatness of space. It was a $60 credit course, Santa Cruz Extension, a voyage of discovery, sponsored by the University of California. One of the speakers there, a friend of mine who also takes these tapes, went to hear it because he used a press pass. It was too late for me to get over to hear this. I wish I had. One of the speakers was Dr. Brian O'Leary from Princeton University, and he works with that Dr. O'Neill who's written up in Alternative 3, in the book Alternative 3. O'Leary is a specialist on the mining of asteroidal materials for manufacturing in space. He says the Earth resources will be depleted, and the man has to think of space living as the answer to more energy, food, and room to live. And as I say, he collects material for living in space. He was asked, did he know the book Alternative 3? And he said no. And he was asked about spaceman Robert Groden, and he wasn't familiar with that name. Another speaker who was supposed to be there that evening, the main speaker, was Russell Schweickart, who was the lunar module pilot for Apollo 9 in 1969 and sent up the backup for the first Skylab mission in 1973. He worked on the jammed solar wing that lost its thermal shield during the Skylab launch. Schweickart is an advisor to Governor Brown on space-related matters and works for NASA. Now, it's interesting, the conference was this last weekend, last Friday, here on the peninsula, but when the Harrisburg incident took place on Thursday, Schweickart was called by Governor Brown to cancel his speech at the Monterey Conference Center that was an extension course, 3-day course, because of possible problems of the plant, nuclear plant, up in Sacramento. Now, it's interesting that a NASA space scientist, an actual astronaut, would be going up to California to work on nuclear plant safety. But Governor Brown called him up to Sacramento, and because of the Harrisburg incident, so that the atomic energy plants and the pollution of the Earth and the solution of the Earth seem to be in the hands of the same people. The theory behind Alternative 3 is the world will be so polluted that we need an alternative place to live, and it's being polluted by the same people that are planning the solution. And if that doesn't make you wonder, think about it a little while. We've known that's been going on a long time. To put our safety and our food and our health and our future or our present in the hands of the very people who are doing the polluting certainly doesn't make sense any more than letting James Schlesinger push for more plants at a time when he doesn't even know the damage that the current one is doing. Another article along the lines of Alternative 3, because certainly I read the news not differently, but with that book in mind, there was an article last Thursday in the Monterey Herald, Associated Press story from Switzerland, that said 1/10 of all babies born last year may die before their first birthday, that 125 million children were born in 1978 and 12 million will die in their first year. But then Dr. Halfdan Mahler, said in Switzerland that this again is the tip of the iceberg, another famous tip of the iceberg. He said an even greater tragedy will come because the survivors from the first year, because of economic, social, or environmental conditions, will never enjoy the fruit of good health or develop to their full human potential. That goes back again to people like Cecil Rhodes and their diamond mines and their superiority of the white race, the white Anglo-Saxon, and working the Africans for slave labor and deciding who lives and dies. In Alternative 3, it brings up the problem of 34 million new people born each year. But you can see, if you take rid of 12 million children from the undeveloped countries, that's 12 from 34 right there. And you can easily, with famine, earthquakes, and disease, balance it off so you don't have any particular growth from these people each year. And furthermore, it suggests if you're poor or in the worst social location, you know, socially, I suppose, as Black, Mexican, Muslim, or Indian, or whatever, and your environment is bad, there will be a greater tragedy because you'll never enjoy the fruit of good health or develop your potential. I want to do a lot more on the South African scandal, the payoffs of $86 million to politicians, but I don't want you to lose sight of a small article. It was so tiny you may not have seen it this week in lieu of the British elections that took place. At the time that this story broke about the payoffs from South Africa, one of the recipients of the money was Margaret Thatcher, the leading British conservative who was running for office against Prime Minister James Callaghan. And the scandal was that South Africa had poured money into Margaret Thatcher's administration. 2 weeks ago on tape number 381, March 23rd, I also commented about the scandal of the South African murder of Robert Smith and his wife, who were murdered a week before the general elections down in South Africa. I titled it Murderous Twist in South Africa, another death just before the elections down there, common up here and common all over the world. They had the elections Thursday, March 29th in England for the British government, and the Washington Post has a frontline headline story, British government ousted by one vote. James Callaghan lost the election as the prime minister, and they're going to have a general election now early in May, and the Conservative Party leader, Margaret Thatcher, is going to run for election. There's no confidence in the Callaghan vote. The Washington Post has a great big story on that subject. The New York Times has a front page story by William Broders. Labour government is ousted in Britain by vote in Commons, the House of Commons. Callaghan beaten by margin of one. Election likely in early May. Now, both of these made front page stories that Margaret Thatcher would likely run for election in May and possibly win, and that Prime Minister James Callaghan would be leaving the office of 10 Downing Street. It made the headlines all over and with a lot of fanfare and nobody making any connections to the possibility of the influence of the possible $86 million secret fund that South Africa uses in the United States and in Britain and also other countries to affect their elections. But the United Press had a story in the San Francisco Chronicle this last week, and if you measure it, I could give you the sentences. They're just 2 inches, and I haven't seen it in my other papers. I'm waiting to see what comes from the New York Times and Washington Post. This is from London, April the 3rd, 1979, United Press. British politician dies, and it's true he's 76 years old. He's old enough to die. He's a man that had the deciding vote in the Labour Party. Sir Alfred Broughton, a Labour Party member of Parliament, was absent from the Commons No Confidence Vote debate March 28th. He had an illness that brought him down, and James Callaghan died. He died from bronchitis, and he died from a heart attack, and he was inconveniently 250 miles away from Parliament to vote. And he was a member of the Labour Party and one of the strong whips with Callaghan. And he just unfortunately got the heart attack and died and didn't vote. This would be the deciding vote in whether or not Margaret Thatcher would win or not. And in lieu of the fact that South African money was mentioned in regard to her political campaign and success, in lieu of the fact that another murder took place by the same conduits a week before the election, I think it would be interesting to know why the headlines wouldn't at least proclaim that Sir Alfred Broughton, the deciding factor in that election, also had a heart attack and died. And there are just too many deaths that take place that are deciding around these electoral processes for me to believe that they're just coincidental. Through the Freedom of Information Act that was just declassified this last week, April the 12th, again, these documents are coming out, and these are the things that John Conley wants to stop from being released. A United Press story says, at the height of the Cold War, the Central Intelligence Agency studied and looked into ways to knock off key guys through what they termed natural causes such as cancer and heart attacks. A heavily censored CIA document from a quarter century ago shows that the CIA considered experimenting on terminal cancer cases under the guise of legitimate medical work. We know that Jack Ruby had a CIA cancer, and Martha Mitchell had a CIA cancer, but the information coming out, the research from the Assassination Information Bureau was released that they were investigating ways to knock off people, methods to produce cancer, methods for heart attacks, and so forth. And I told you before that I have talked to a gentleman who said that he gave the heart attack to William Harvey of the CIA just after he testified before the Senator Church Committee. February 4th, 1952, memo on chemical branch research and development, give heart attacks and give cancer. It's hard to believe that the started that far back using this as a weapon and didn't perfect it to the point that they can use it all the time right now. Jimmy Carter was in Dallas, Texas, several days before the nuclear incident in Pennsylvania, and he was talking to the National Public and Radio Mutual Broadcasting people, giving a lecture in Dallas, Texas. Did you know there was a plan to kill Jimmy Carter in Texas, and that the only newspaper that I have that wrote about it was the Washington Post, Saturday, March 17th, 1979. It said, warrant issued in death plot against Jimmy Carter. A federal warrant was issued for a Texas man who the Secret Service agents had paid $10,000 to have Carter assassinated. This man has been arrested. His name is William Rodney Etheridge, 23, of Odessa, Texas. He's wanted from the state of Utah. He's a fugitive from justice in Utah. Remember the same man that told me about the plans to kill Harvey that he did with the fake heart attack, that the original orders come from Utah, and that Utah is involved in these assassinations. Why is it that only the Washington Post wrote an article that a man was arrested and that there was a death plot on the United States president? This came out March 17th, that the man was arrested. Jimmy Carter was down in Dallas on the 23rd. The reason there was so much silence is that they want to do it, and they don't want to break the chain of command of the people who will kill him if they want to get away with it. More on Jonestown next week. Sorry the tape is up. Again, it goes too fast. Take care, and I'll be with you next week.